KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. And thank you for tuning in today. Today we're going to have a what I think will be a far-ranging and interesting discussion involving a technology and its impact on literally everyone that lives in a country on the planet. The issue is national identification cards. I have a guest today, which I will introduce in a moment, to discuss this really perplexing issue, but one that everyone should be aware of, because the day is coming quickly when this technology is going to expand not only beyond Europe, where it is currently, but will be picked up in the United States and other parts of the globe. National identification cards are an idea that's been, you know, kicked around for quite a while. There are people that say we, in the United States, that we already have a national identification card because we have a Social Security number that we carry with us. But as our guest will discuss, there's a lot more to it than that. Today's guest is Christoph Engemann, a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society. So I continue my collection of talking to very interesting people who are affiliated with the center. Chris is a media sociologist from the Graduate School of Social Sciences in Bremen, Germany, and in addition to being a non-resident fellow. His research interests are e-government, electronic government, history of authentication media, media theory, and European unification and its media. The one interesting fact about Chris, which will distinguish him from some of the other guests I have, is that Chris is not an attorney. However, this issue touches on so many issues involving law and its interaction that its application and really the interest at the law level is something that we will be discussing a bit today as well. So I look forward to this interesting discussion. When we take our break in a moment to listen to some additional songs, we'll come back and discuss. And I should add what I don't normally do, but today's theme is the first song that we had there, which is World Party's Ship of Fools, excuse me. When we come back, I will introduce Chris and we'll begin our discussion. That's a soundtrack of our lives, the song Surround Sister. We shouldn't be afraid to fall, but welcome, Chris. And maybe we'll see whether we're going to be falling as we discuss these issues and their implication, because I think people will be interested to hear what's going on with this technology. So thank you for coming today.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me here.
Why don't we start off first of all, I introduced you briefly, but why don't you give me kind of an overview of, first of all, what a national ID card is, what we mean when we say that, and also a little bit about how you got into looking at this issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what is a national ID card? I prefer to speak of national ID card systems because the ID card is only sort of the front end of that system, which the user, the citizen in that case, has. And the back end of an ID card system is some sort of registry, some sort of database where that information that is on that card is duplicated. And only in conjunction, the registry and the ID card make up a system that allows it to identify individuals. So the ID card is basically a small card that an individual carries or owns that stores or that bears his name, his birth date, his birthplace, his nationality, his signature, very importantly, and a photograph of the bearer. And in most cases, it also bears his address, his current residence. And most European countries have these sorts of ID card systems. So the citizen carries this card, and the state sort of stores the information that is on this card in some sort of registry. And if there's some dispute, one can look if the data on both sides is consistent. And that is what an identification is.
Is you said it was pretty prevalent. How far has it gone in terms of its spread in Europe? Is it something which is subject to any controversy at this point, or is it really entrenched?
Well, I would say in most of continental and northern Europe, it's just entrenched, and there's no more discussion or controversy about that. There's a basic rule of thumb. All civil law countries have some sort of ID card systems, and to this date, no common law country has any ID cards, and this is about to change right now.
What why don't you describe kind of physically what the card, at least the card that you have, looks like?
Well, the German ID card, so-called Personalausweis, which I'm just holding now, is a card roughly like twice the size of a credit card, which is printed on paper and then wrapped into plastic. And so to make it ruggable, but also the plastic contains some sort of special treatment so that it's not so easy to duplicate or to copy it. There's a hologram embedded in it, and it will change its appearance under ultraviolet light. And you can even, if you touch it, feel that some treatment is given to the surface. So that once you touch it, you in the first moment have the impression it's something special. And on the left side of the card is a photograph, and on the right side is the basic information, given name, first, last name, birth date, birthplace, nationality, and so forth. And on the back side, my current address is registered, as well as the colors of my eyes and my height.
So is the card, I'm trying, just for people that obviously can't see it, is it? It sounds akin to a U.S. passport in a lot of ways, in terms of what you're describing.
Yeah, basically that's true, and some even refer to it as internal passports. The difference is that it is not a book; it's a single card. Whereas the passport has a book-like appearance, and the pages in the passport are there for stamping visas into them. So, since no visas are being stamped on identification cards, no book is needed. But usually the third page in a passport that contains the photo and the personal information is very, very similar to what an ID card looks like.
And what kind of, for those listening who aren't intimately familiar with the issue, what is the policy driving the need or the interest in having individuals have these cards, at least in Europe? And we can talk a little later about what's happening in the United States and draw some comparisons.
Well, that to answer that question, one has to go a little bit into history. Basically, Europe saw two world wars in the course of the 20th century, and also saw the development of a quite elaborate welfare state. And these two developments sort of brought up the need to identify individuals in a given territory. So the world wars came along with the necessity to identify if somebody is a national of this or that country, and if not, to sort of control his movements. And that was, in that case, the First World War, when ID cards were introduced in most places. There were predecessors of ID cards, but no, they were not compulsory. So Great Britain, for example, introduced actually an ID card in 1914, abandoned it after the First World War, but basically everybody had to register, and the state wanted to have an overview how many foreigners are actually in the country and to control their movements and their whereabouts. And the same was, of course, true for the Second World War. And after the Second World War, in Great Britain, again, the card were abandoned, whereas in continental Europe, they just stayed there. And what we also saw was the development of welfare state regimes. And this means that people are actually provided with something by the state if they can identify themselves as legitimate, you know, as if they can identify themselves and that show that they're eligible to get some sort of provisions. So
is it a function of control that we're talking about here?
Well,
ultimately,
it is basically control versus provision. And ID cards sort of oscillate between these two, and the one cannot be put apart from the other one. You know, control, even if you provide something like in welfare state regime, you have to control who gets that. Mm-hmm. And of course, ID cards were used as means of control, and they played a huge role in conscription, in discriminating colonial subjects, and not at least in the Holocaust. All this would have not been, you know, manageable without some sort of registries about who is who and being able to identify individuals that you wanted to discriminate for. That's negative discrimination. Mm-hmm. Welfare states do positive discrimination. They just want to know, is this subject eligible for, say, educational benefits, for unemployment insurance, for healthcare, and whatever else welfare states provide.
So it's an interesting concept, because up until now, people were certainly holding identification cards of one form or another. But what you're describing here is a card that would really identify you to the state and identify potentially what you can and cannot do beyond driving or collecting a Social Security check, right?
Well, it depends on what is stored in the system.
That so
is,
what kind of information are we looking at in Europe?
Yeah. So in Germany, it is compulsory to own a card. It is not compulsory to carry the card. So basically, if there's some sort of dispute, you have to be able, at least after the fact, to produce either a passport or an identification card. In France, for example, you have to actually carry it. The card or the system itself doesn't contain that much information. It's just, you know, information that allows to identify you as a citizen. Nothing else. And the German card is machine readable. And if, for example, a policeman slides the card through that machine, the machine will only return if this card has been flagged. It will not return any intentional personal information. So the way the system is compromised right now, it does not allow control to the extent we just, you know, we're sort of touching upon. Mm-hmm. But that could be made possible. And this is the policy question that is up in the air right now, when the whole ID card system move into the domain of the digital, because you can connect data in whole different ways then.
So when someone, I want to get a sense of what a person, say, in Germany is doing with the card. Mm-hmm. So certainly, if one were to take a very simplified view of things, you have the movie image of what happens when you have a card.
Yes.
You know, may I see your papers, where you're stopped on the street randomly by someone who purports to have authority to ask you that question.
Yes.
We're not talking about something at that level of control, or are we?
No, right now we are not talking about that, although in Germany, basically, everybody carries this card, and if you're being stopped, a policeman will ask for that card, because he just expect to have you one you know, carrying it along, and people will show it. Mm-hmm. But the law definitely does not oblige you to do that. Mm-hmm. You know,
is it held against you if you don't?
By law, not, but mm-hmm. I guess informally, yes.
Right.
So that's absolutely an issue that is there. But again, the public perception in most of continental Europe is not that ID cards are about control, but they're about provision, because mm-hmm. the frequency of contacts that you have with the government are higher in countries where you have a welfare state, because you have public funding for schools and healthcare and so forth. And on each of these events, you have to provide your identity. And that's what people associate these cards with, and not with, you know, some state that actually takes away your freedom or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's more like the state provides your freedom to act, because you get health care and get back on your feet again.
So the card itself, as I take from what you're saying, first of all, it's not an optional thing. You have to have one.
You have to have one.
And in terms of the technology itself, is describe for the listeners briefly how that information is transmitted. Is it something that you enter yourself, or you go to a government agency and they provide it, or is the card literally a means of access to other databases. Okay. How does that work?
Okay. Right now, the card is not the means of access to any database. The only database that can be accessed is these police databases that only will show if somebody is flagged. It will not, you know, give back personal information and so forth. It will just show if a person is sought after. The way it works is that once you turn 16, you have to get one of these Personalausweis identification cards, and you basically take your birth certificate to the Meldestelle, the registration office of your local city, and there you will be issued one of these ID cards, which has to be renewed after 5 years. And beyond that, there is no access to any databases. You have to show the card if you want to get access to official provisions. You know, mm-hmm. if you go, for example, if you change your school and so forth. It's also important that there is compulsory registration in Germany. That means once you move, you have to go to the registration office at in 14 days and register your new address, and the ID card will be reissued, and the data, of course, in the registry will be changed. And the registries are held local. There are no central registries right now.
Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, from how you describe it, really my immediate reaction might be, what's the big deal? You have a card. Where is the conflict in a nutshell? We can get into more details in a moment.
Well, the conflict could be that this data is being linked and is being sort of stored in a different way. The way it is organized right now, this card doesn't facilitate regimes of control so much, because it's hard to access the data for officials, and it's hard to judge upon anybody upon the card and the data that is on it. But since we move right now into the digital domain with public administrations, and that is what e-government is about, this whole new identification systems have to be re-implemented. And this is a chance, or this also bears the danger, that other regimes of how to identify individuals are put into place. And this is the policy question that we have to take care about right now.
Well, I think that's a good segue, because ultimately, I think, and we'll talk about it, the United States would have a very different view of this, primarily, I think, aside from a historical skepticism about the power of government, but also because I'm not convinced, at least in the U.S., that you're going to have the same benefits of having a card from what you describe of a citizen in Germany having the card and as a result having access to healthcare and what have
yes.
you. So when we come back from a short music break, let's dive into that issue and see where it takes us. Glenn Snyde there with I Love the Unknown. Great band. I think they're based out of Brooklyn, New York. At any rate, we're back with Chris Engemann here on Hearsay Culture. I'm Dave Levine, and you're listening to KZSU. Chris, before the break, we were talking a bit and starting to get into some of the comparisons between what's happening in Europe and what might be happening here. So why don't we expand on that a little bit? Where is the United States as compared to Europe on national ID cards?
Yeah, right now the United States don't have a ID card regime, so people are free not to own an ID card. Actually, there's no system in place of cards that they could own. What is used, nevertheless, as means of identification are the social security numbers and the driver's license. So, for example, if you want to register for vote, you have to show your driver's license. And right now, the U.S. are investigating to introduce some form of ID card in the near future. And what might be the reason for this? So in the public consciousness, it's usually associated with the war on terror and with the necessity to identify, you know, so-called terrorists within the U.S. And the government makes an argument that identity cards might help in doing so. That might be one aspect of why identity cards are being discussed about. I personally think there's another reason that is at least as much, if not even more, important to the introduction of ID cards, and that is the Internet. So the Internet is basically a sort of a new transaction space. People conduct, you know, in the space daily, transfer huge sums. New classes of goods have emerged. And sometimes these goods don't even exist beyond the Internet, like some sort of software or chat clients, games, and so forth. And furthermore, the Internet connects people on a global basis, and their actions traverse the globe, might emanate in this country and terminate in another country. So when you look at the Internet as a transaction space and compare it to the real space, you will see that the real space is also transaction space, and that in that space, national states have sort of monopolized the control over the movements of people and goods in the late 19th century. And have established border controls and in order to be able to tax to do customs and to also do the taxes and even deny certain people to enter or leave the country. Mm-hmm. So the Internet now challenges this monopoly over the control of goods and the actions of people. And if you want to have control over this, and the argument why to do so is, first, the state wants to tax transactions or might wants to impose customs on transactions. And second, states wants to prevent fraud. Mm-hmm. You need means of identifying the transaction partners within this new domain. And this is exactly what is the issue right now. You cannot, you know, in a legally safe way, identify the transaction partners.
Is it a matter in the United States, as you mentioned, you know, you talk about a driver's license or a Social Security card. So the Social Security card is coming from the federal level. It's coming right. from a central government right. that who control the issuance of the cards, the number itself, and ultimately how Congress will control how that number can be used, so that U.S. law makes it illegal for one to compulsorily use or an employer to compulsorily use a Social Security number as an identification means.
Mm-hmm.
Contrast that with a driver's license, which is a state-issued document, and the states have different standards for issuing the driver's license and what have you. When we look at Europe, which is obviously heading, and you know, tell me if I'm wrong, but heading towards this form of unified Europe and unified identification, the United States already has this unified identification. We're all American citizens. So what is it that the National ID card is doing that the states aren't already doing by issuing a driver's license, which they control, which they monitor, and by Congress and the federal government controlling Social Security cards?
I would say that I would like to carry the discussion in a different direction here.
Okay.
Because I think we have to think about why does a state on any level has an interest in identifying individuals?
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at from that at the issue from that perspective, you will find that the state, that any state in the world, already sort of monopolized identifying people on a very basic level. Physical entry in any territory goes along with some sort of identification. If I cross a border, you know, I have to show a passport, otherwise I won't be able to. And people accept that as a fact of life. Nobody expects to be able to travel without a passport.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one way to enter a territory. The other way is to be born. And if somebody is born in a given territory, a birth certificate is being created that bears the name of that individual, birthplace and date and so forth. So in a very basic way, providing an identity, a name and so forth to an individual is one of the basic functions of any state. Now comes the question, at which events should this identity be provided? And I think that's where Europe and the U.S. differ.
Mm-hmm.
In Europe, as I said, there are much more occasions of sort of having contact with the government due to the welfare state and so forth. And you're obliged to provide your identity, whereas this is not happening in the U.S. So why might the U.S. be interested in having some sort of identification, although there's no welfare state coming up and so forth?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and that was my point before, that the internet poses the problem. The U.S. wants to tax and to impose custom rules. And wants to be able to prevent fraud in this new transaction space. In order to do so, it needs means of identifying individuals. So my point is what the identity cards are about that are being talked, that are in the air right now, is a means of digital identification.
Mm-hmm.
So the identity card will contain some sort of cryptographic component that allows individuals to identify themselves for online transactions.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is much more beyond the push for identification cards. Same in Great Britain. Mm-hmm. And the new identification cards that we get in Germany, for example, also contain this cryptographic element.
When you talk about the cryptographic element, for those that aren't intimately familiar, how does that technology work?
Basically, the technology allows a person to sign, like with a personal signature, contracts on the internet. It's called digital signature, and the card contains a code, and the individual holds a PIN number, just like on an ATM machine. And if you, for example, write an email and want to make very sure that people can see that you and nobody else wrote that email and nobody altered the email on the course of the transaction in the internet, you can use this card and your number and sort of digitally sign your email.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically a digital implementation of one's own signature.
Is it similar to simply signing a letter and putting it in the mail?
Yes and no. With a normal signature that we do by our own hand, we have to again look into where does the legitimacy of this signature come from.
Mm-hmm.
And here we will again find it comes from the fact that somewhere a state authority has stored a copy of your signature.
Mm-hmm.
And in case of dispute, the signature that is being stored and the signature that is on some sort of contract or whatever can be compared.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be derived from that point if you were really the one who underwrote this or not. So with the digital signature, there is no writing of one's own stored anywhere. The state basically issues you a number.
Mm-hmm.
And you have that number, and the state has sort of a copy. It's more complicated than that. It's the technique is called public key infrastructure, and I won't go into that, but it's a very elaborate system of making sure that these two numbers correspond and cannot be altered.
It definitely makes sense that we would want to have that kind of technology as the internet becomes more pervasive. And this show is being recorded on June 9th, and so yesterday it was announced that Zarqawi was apparently killed. We're in a climate where that's big news. The fact that a terrorist leader in Iraq was apparently killed in a bombing is big news here. And it seems like the national ID card debate, at least in the United States, does not focus on the kind of things you're talking about at all. I mean, not even that it's a side issue. What you're describing here, unless you follow this issue very closely, I don't think is how people, if they have any perception at all of the issue, would view it. It's viewed as a situation where the United States government, the federal government, is seeking to monitor your movements, see where you're going, see where you're going to go next. And it doesn't sound like that's at all what you're describing with the technology in the United States. What's happened? Why is there this gap between what the intentions or the purposes of the technology is and what I think based on non-empirical data, but just anecdotally people think about this.
I don't know why it is like that. I can't answer that. But I think the description is absolutely true. And I wouldn't deny that the state still has an interest in controlling the individuals and their movement. And the new technology, digital, you know, based identities allow a degree of control of movement that is unprecedented. And we have to absolutely be very observant about what happens here and how this is being used. And this, again, is an issue that the public actually could have control about, because the implementation of how this digital signatures comes into being is something which is a political question. Mm-hmm. And there are different ways to implement that. And as Larry Lessig has pointed out, code is not nature. You know, it's all society. So society has to decide upon in what way these authentication or identification regimes are being implemented. And you can implement it in a way that allows, you know, centralized total control, a very Orwellian notion of things. And you can implement it in different ways that makes it very hard for central authorities or for any authorities to access the data or to combine the data and so forth. This bears different dangers, which are not smaller than what I just described, because people might you know, if you give, for one way to solve this problem would be to give total control about any personal data to the individuals. Mm-hmm. And people might face incentives that make them give away their data.
Right. You know? And I think that kind of gets back to your point about how these cards are perceived in Europe. This technology itself, I'm assuming, is technology that's created by private industry to be sold to governments to use. Is that fair? Because what I'm getting at here, it gets back to, you know, an area of personal interest to me and something that you and I have discussed separately, which is the issue of public-private partnerships.
Yes.
And it seems to me that the control of the data is really where the nux or the crux of – not nux is not a word – the crux of the problem lies. There's a healthy skepticism. I think it's a good thing in a democracy that you don't want to have an all-powerful government that knows all, and you want to know, especially, that what that government is going to do with the data. I wonder whether the technology itself deriving from private industry and perhaps a private element controlling the data would change the perception of what a national ID card is. For example, I have a card that I purchased from a health management organization, an HMO. They give me a card. They know a tremendous amount about me. They may know more than I realize they know, but they know about my health and what have you. And I don't think too many people would be all that upset if they, you know, by getting that card, because like you said, in Europe, there's a benefit attached to it. Unless you're suggesting that the national ID card in the United States would allow you to use the roads, call the police, what have you, it doesn't seem like you have the same comparison. But I'm wondering whether, from a private-public partnership perspective, some of those concerns might be alleviated.
That's a couple of questions. Let me start at the end. The benefit that an ID card in the U.S. will have, if it's coming and contains a digital signature or some sort of means of authentifying or identifying somebody in a digital domain, is transaction safety.
Mm-hmm.
So that boils down to possibly less spam, less viruses, less fraud on eBay or whatever, because you can identify easily whom you're dealing with and where code is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And one point I didn't mention was, of course, digital rights management also tap into this, because
right.
you want to confine the users of certain files to certain persons. Therefore, you have to know who is dealing with the software, mm-hmm. and so forth. So that is that. There is a benefit, and it's an economic benefit, and it's a safety benefit. And for a capitalistic society, there is basically always some sort of identification needed. Mm-hmm. And if capitalism wants to go digital, it needs identities. It boils down to that. Concerning the question who issues and controls the cards, it cannot be solved privately. I think that is what Microsoft learned with Passport, and that's why they push into a more open source oriented direction right now.
Open source meaning that the access to the programming itself is not subject to licenses,
right,
and what have you.
Yes. The identity card system they now or digital identity system they now propose is a very open standards based approach. It cannot be solved privately because nobody will trust a private entity to control identity data. Nobody will trust Microsoft or Google or Apple or any other private actor not to use this private data for business or some sort of private interests. This is a definite problem that the public side has to solve, that the government has to solve. And the question is, to what degree do private and public sides work together in solving this? And here mm-hmm. we have huge differences between Europe and the U.S. In Europe, we have very, very early, in the early 90s already, government-driven approaches to solve the problem of digital identities. And in Germany, the first legislation was actually in 96. And since 96, the German government tries to implement digital signatures for electronic government purposes and for e-business, of course. They didn't succeed so far because they underestimated the technical and legal difficulties, but they're still on it. Mm-hmm. The U.S. are actually in this domain a late starter. You know, there were some legislation, for example, in Utah already in 93, but there was no concentrated push. It was not high on the agenda to solve the digital identity problem within the governments, either federal or state governments. What we saw instead was that the private sector tried to come up with solutions. One of them I just mentioned, Microsoft Passport, but very low adaption, very low degree of security, of reliability, and so forth. And in the end, the issue of trust was not solved, trust in the identity provider. Now we see that both the private and public sector try to come up with a solution for online authentication. And we see actors like the Liberty Alliance, which is compromised of Sun Microsystems, of a huge number of telcos and banks and so forth. We see Microsoft's new approach and a couple of others coming up with open standard identification technologies mm-hmm. that they sort of offer the state to adopt.
I see.
And the state itself, or the government itself tries to come up with rules, with standards on what has to be in there and how is it going to be solved. But I expect that the state, also in the U.S., in the end will monopolize the initial authentication. That means just like the state registers births, the state will register the first entry or some sort of the first authentication in the internet.
Nice.
How these identities are federated beyond that point, that is the question that can be solved differently.
Mm-hmm.
And here Europe solves it by having some sort of state-run agency doing that. And in the U.S., I guess we will see some sort of public-private venture or even a private institution solve this problem.
I think you mentioned the security issue and the minutes that we have left. Again, another topic that we could discuss further in another show. And hopefully, if you come back stateside, or we can do it by telephone, I'd love to have you back. When I was doing some research on this issue, I came across a blog from the Hasbrook.org blog dealing with encrypted passport data being intercepted and cracked. This was a blog entry from January 30th of this year, but basically it reported, and I'm reading it verbatim, a Dutch television news program has commissioned experiments by security research firm Riscure in which radio communications between the chip and a prototype Dutch passport. Using the same technology, according to this blog, an encryption scheme recently adopted as an international standard and being deployed in the United States, where, and this is incredible, intercepted, stored for analysis later at leisure, the password was cracked in about 2 hours on a PC, and the digitized fingerprint photographed and all other encrypted and plain text data on the chip in the password recovered. Yes. What that effectively means is that the reliance that any individual is going to place on this technology seems to be wholly dependent on its ability to maintain confidentiality. If that's true, if that happened, and I understand that it did happen, then what is the future of this technology in the absence of total security? Because it's unreasonable, I would think, for a government or a private entity to ask you to reveal this kind of data if the data itself is being transmitted in a non-secure way, such that a person using a PC in a couple of hours was able to access all of it.
Yes. I mean, this is a very fundamental problem that this technology brings with it. And what happened in this case is that a special feature of these passports was exploited, and that is the so-called RFID chip that is contained in these new passports that are being issued in most of Europe and will also be part of the identity card in Germany from 2008 on. So RFID means radio frequency identification, and it's basically a very tiny chip, so tiny that it can even be printed in some cases. And this chip, this RFID tag consists of an antenna and a chip that stores the data. And a reader basically can read the data on the chip at a distance from roughly about 3 meters, possibly 10 meters, depends. So 10 to 30 foot. The data stored on these chips is encrypted, and obviously it was cracked. And government agencies try to answer this challenge by encrypting it even more. But it's basically an arms race, and I guess in the long run it can't be solved. You can make it just prohibitively expensive to crack the encryption on that, and that's what they are trying to do. These RFID tags, the possibility to read the identification document at a distance is being disputed. Mm-hmm. And
being disputed meaning that they're not sure that in fact is the case.
No, I'm sorry. That means that there is a strong opposition against it.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Sorry. The reason for implementing this RFID tags is that you can ease identification events. For example, if a passport contains this radio readability of its data, it means you can have quicker check-throughs because people don't have to show it, and you don't have to have an officer to control and compare. You could have an automated system, a camera, that reads your face and whatever, and compares that data to the data it read wirelessly from your passport.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can have comparably very high throughput rates at gates, and that is the reason. Of course, this technology could also be used for different purposes. You can put a reader anywhere. They're very small. You can conceal them easily, and you can put them whatever in restaurants, and could therefore access the movement patterns of people and the whereabout of people and so forth. And the government denies to have an interest in that, although, in an event of a crisis, you never know what might happen.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one thing. The other thing is that any private actor, as we just heard, or any criminal, could possibly crack the encryption and, amass huge amounts of data. Let's say some sort of, big supermarket chain puts in readers. They have this RFID readers anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And secretly cracks, the encryption and reads out not only what goods are being, bought in the store, but also by whom. You could build vast databases about consumer behavior and so forth. So these are the issues that are here, and it's very difficult to get a grip on how to solve that.
And I think that that's unfortunately, because of our time, that's going to have the last point on it. It sounds to me like we're really, despite the fact that these cards have been in existence in Europe for quite some time, we're still at the beginning stages of figuring out how all of this will work, which is an obvious segue to having you back on the show. Before we close, I just wanted to offer an opportunity for anyone that wants to get in touch with you or just reach out or find works on this area. What would you recommend, and what is your contact info?
Yeah, my contact is quite simply my email address, which is the only static in my otherwise pretty nomadic life right now. And my email address is cengeman@stanford.edu. And I'd be happy to get in touch with you.
Terrific. Well, we were very fortunate, and I'm very fortunate to have you here, because I know you're heading back to Germany next week. And by the time this show airs, I guess in late June, you're not going to be here. So I want to thank you, Chris, for coming in today and discussing this issue. I mean, we're really seeing with the National ID card, I think, another example of where we have technology that works but doesn't work perfectly and has significant issues. And there's a major public perception issue when you deploy technology that turns out to fail and how people will react to it after that first interaction. So it's critical that those first interactions go as smoothly as possible. Well, thank you for coming in today. I'm going to take a short music break, and then when I come back, I'm going to close the show. So thanks again, Chris, for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
I want to thank Chris for coming in again today. Fascinating conversation. I'm beginning to see that I could probably do a longer than hour show. I'll get more ambitious as time passes. But I want to thank you again for listening to Hearsay Culture. This is a show that airs Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. The show is also found on iTunes. If you type Center for Internet and Society, you will find on the podcast listing, you'll come across Hearsay Culture, as well as some great additional events that occur at Stanford Law School through the Center for Internet and Society. The website for the center is cyberlaw.stanford.edu. So thank you again for listening. I hope you found it informative, and we'll talk next time.